I'm Greg Johnson.
And I'm John Morgan.
I'm Michael Polignano.
Welcome back to another weekly episode of Countercurrents Radio. I want to begin today with some thank yous. We received a bunch of donations to our P.O. box, and it takes a while for these things to be forwarded to me. So I want to, first of all, apologize for the belated thank yous that a lot of you are getting. So I'm just going to either say the last name or the location or some other thing, some other clue that will allow the donor to figure out that I'm speaking to them. But of course, I'm not going to in any way violate somebody's privacy. So first of all, thank you for $50 from Greenville. We received another $20 from Randy, $50 from Matthew, $100 from Richard, $50 from Jerome, $50 from Brian, $200 from Richmond, €40 and 10 quid from Aiden, $150 from Oakton, $50 from RC, $100 from Benjamin, $300 from San Francisco, $25 from Joseph, $20 from Gunner, $50 from John, another $20 from Randy, $100 from Mariana, $25 from Nelson, $250 from San Francisco, $14 from Jonathan, and $50 from IE. So thank you all very much for that. It's very generous support, and it comes, of course, in a time of need. And I just want to mention to you, and I'm going to be reinforcing this with a fundraising email and also a fundraising post on the website. More than 6 weeks ago now, we were cut off from PayPal. It was part of the wave of deplatforming that took place after the Unite the Right rally and the moral hysteria that followed that. And it has been very damaging to us. We lost all of our monthly donors, basically, except for a couple of people who are using a different method. And our monthly donors are what keep us afloat. So we have been trying to get those monthly donors back. Now, we've gotten more than half the monthly donations back, but we've gotten fewer than half the monthly donors back. And so we really need people to go to the donate site or scroll down on this page, if you're listening to it right now, scroll down on the Countercurrents Radio page and the donation form will be there. And please, if you were doing a monthly donation, sign up to do it again. If you would like to take up the slack for some people who are just not going to re-up because for whatever reasons, some people use throwaway mail addresses that they don't check, and so they just don't know that this has happened. Others are probably thinking, well, I gave for 5 years. It's time to stop. Others just don't trust anything that's not PayPal, even though PayPal hates us, right? So some people have dropped out. It's inevitable. People come in and drop out all the time. And when you're deplatformed like this, this will lead a number of people to finally say, well, time to stop, right? So if you want to make up the slack for those who are stopping and you haven't done a monthly donation, please do this today. It really is a very important thing. We need to get back up to where we were before so we have a stable floor. Again, any kind of radical ideas generally do not have a platform in this world without donors to make that possible. Our donors made that possible. That's why they attacked our donation platform. That's why they took it away. They want to destroy us. So if you want us to stay in business, out there on the web, bringing you podcasts and essays and books, you've got to re-up for a monthly donation or start doing a monthly donation. So please do that today, and thank you very much.
Yes, thanks a lot. It means a lot.
Yeah, I really, this will sound like a cliche, but I really think about it every day, the fact that there are people out there willing to sacrifice their hard-earned dollars so that we can do this. And for that, yeah, we're very grateful.
So those of you who are subscribed to the NFL or some sports ball network or whatever and are thinking it's time to cancel this, those of you who want to kill your television and get your life back more generally, those of you who have decided that Netflix sucks and you want to cancel your membership, do that. do that today and send some of the money to people who are fighting the propaganda that you were paying and are paying to have piped into your home and piped into your brain. We are being poisoned, and we're paying for the privilege of being poisoned. Whereas for most of the people who listen to this podcast or read this website are not paying for the antidote, and we are the antidote. So please, take this as an opportunity not only to start supporting something that's good, but to stop supporting something that's bad. Let's shift some of these resources from the people who are trying to ruin you to the people who are trying to save you. So thank you very much. I want to talk now about the situation in America today. The country feels like it is falling apart. And the most recent event, of course, is this terrible massacre in Las Vegas. We still don't know very much about it. But as Ann Coulter pointed out, with each hour that passes and we don't get any positive information about a criminal, that increases the likelihood that the truth about this crime is harmful to the establishment, harmful to the narratives and interests being pushed by the media establishment and the political establishment. And there is a lot of mystery still about this shooter and his motives and his connections. And I'm starting to believe that it's because he was either some sort of leftist, gaslighted by Hillary Clinton and the mainstream media and all this chatter and LARPing about the resistance to fascism, or he was a Muslim and ISIS was telling the truth when they took credit for this terrible attack. So folks, what do you guys think about it? Have you been following it, John, Mike?
Oh, yeah, I've been following it, since I first heard about it. I guess it was Monday morning, the time here in Europe. And I've looked into it, and really, I know a lot of people, including the feds at this point, are dismissing the Muslim possibility, and it may be BS, I don't know, but there certainly are enough compelling connections that I would say that it's at least a possibility, because this guy had this mysterious girlfriend from the Philippines. And as we know, I mean, the Philippines has a significant Muslim population, which has a history of producing Islamic radicalist terrorist groups. And admittedly, from what I've been able to read up about this woman online, she doesn't really seem like that type. But I mean, who knows? I mean, the whole thing with terrorists is that you don't know who they are. So, I mean, there might be some sort of connection there. The other thing is that in May of this year, I think it was May, possibly April, ISIS actually issued a call for an attack on the Las Vegas Strip. So that's exactly what we have here. Wow. So it might just be a coincidence, but they actually called for that to happen. So, the people who know this guy say that he never evinced any interest in religion or in radicalism, which might be true, but these same people are also the ones who are saying that they can't imagine that, he would actually, get a bunch of guns together and do something like this.
And he obviously did.
Yeah, so
these people are either lying or they didn't know the guy very well.
Right.
But again, we've heard this before. He was a good boy. He didn't do nothing, right?
Mm-hmm.
We've heard that before, and obviously it's not always true.
Apparently his father was a bank robber who made it on to the FBI's 10 most wanted list in the 60s, and he had some sort of shootout with the police in Las Vegas. So, I mean, that in itself doesn't necessarily suggest a connection, but when you're dealing with a guy who's obviously a psychotic, who knows? Maybe he thought in some weird way he was avenging his father or, doing something that he believes his father wanted to do but couldn't. So, I mean, there's a lot going on here. But, of course, the left wants to immediately switch the conversation to guns. But like you said, Greg, I mean, I think the real question here is what's wrong with America that's producing people like this, because there certainly are other societies where people are heavily armed and they don't go off on these kinds of psychotic shooting sprees with such regularity.
Right. One thing that we can say, just based on what we know so far, and this actually supports our worldview, is that there is ample evidence that psychopathic personality traits are highly heritable in all races, including our own. And this might be a case of the apple not falling too far from the tree. The guy's brother, when he was interviewed, was a freak. Did you see the interview with the brother? His behavior was extremely strange. Strange
I only read
language
it.
And facial language, you know, closing his eyes and clenching his face up and gibbering. I didn't think that he seemed particularly credible. I think this whole family might just be cursed with sociopathic genes, and that might be the end of it, unfortunately. But there are lots of sociopaths who don't go doing mass murder as well. So there surely were other factors that contributed to this. My question is, what were these other factors? Was it the general gaslighting of leftists since the Trump victory, all this LARPing about resistance and so forth? Because country music is very much associated with white people. That doesn't mean that everybody in the audience was white, but it's a very white thing to do. Maybe Certainly. This guy was, and it's a very Republican thing to do. There are all these country music musicians who are and were Republicans and would endorse Republican candidates. It's a white Republican thing. Maybe this guy was going to kill some white Republicans. Maybe that was his thought. Or maybe this was a case of a sociopathic American who was convinced by ISIS to join their crusade. Maybe simply because, and this is probably true of a lot of people who join Islam, Islam gives you a divine imprimatur, divine, even not just approval, but a commandment to engage in murder, rape, and mayhem. So it's highly attractive, I would think, to sociopathic personality types. So anyway, we need to know more. But again, the longer we go without clear answers, the greater the likelihood that it's something very damaging to the establishment. And I'm betting he's either a leftist, an Antifa, a member of the resistance, or a Muslim. And the third most likely possibility that I think is fading as time goes on is he's just, a homegrown nut. And there's no way of getting rid of those, really, except having a healthier society, I suppose. This guy was a gambler, a race mixer. I mean, there are lots of warning signs about this guy. But, you know, if he lived in a healthier society, he might never have actualized this level of evil.
I read that he transferred $100,000 out of the country to the Philippines immediately before he did this. He was, you know, just basically clearing out his savings, whatever earnings he had made as a professional gambler. Whether it's because he was a convert to Islam and wanted to, send that to benefit, you know, God knows who, you know, whatever Islamic terrorist organizations are out there.
That struck me because, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mike, but I just wanted to mention that, you know, after 9/11, I read up quite a bit about it, and the 9/11 hijackers in the couple of days before 9/11, you know, they'd been given, you know, how X hundreds of thousands of dollars by Al-Qaeda to carry out the attack, and they returned that money through transfers in the couple of days before the attack, so... When I read that in the reports, I immediately thought of that similarity.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it is odd that it, you know, leaves the country. Of course, you know, anything that's acquired that's related to terrorism will immediately be locked down, you know, under international agreements with the banking industry. It'll just freeze accounts. But, you know, once it's left domestically in a foreign country. I don't think that you know, is easy to do. So.
Right. So he was either sending it off to his girlfriend's family, perhaps, or to some Al-Qaeda affiliate in the Philippines, one or the other. It doesn't seem like he was planning to flee the country to the Philippines.
No, I don't think he intended to survive. That's pretty clear.
Yeah. But it is very interesting that if he did something like that, it indicates that he was not a completely sociopathic person, right? Because if it was just all about himself and about killing people, he wouldn't have made any provisions to send money abroad, right? If he's dead, what difference does his money make to him? Obviously, he cared that that money was in the right hands. So he cared about something. The question is, what did he care about?
Greg, you mentioned about how odd it is that, you know, as more time passes, no motive is given. And that also makes me think of this driver in Charlottesville 2 months ago. I mean, it's been nearly 2 months and he still hasn't been given an opportunity to present his version of what actually happened, which is, you know, I mean, now the media's narrative of what happened is basically set in stone, whatever he says. I mean, I assume it will all come out at his trial.
Right.
But it seems like it's the same thing. I mean, maybe they have uncovered some connection to ISIS or whatever, but, you know, they fear some kind of backlash against the Muslim community. So they, you know, they want to keep that out of people's minds until they don't care anymore.
Yeah, I love how concerned they are with every community but the majority of Americans, right?
Yes. Yes.
That's always how it is.
Yeah, it's always how it is when you're ruled by basically aliens and traitors. Americans just don't come first.
Yeah. Just knowing the fact, I mean, I hate to say it. I really hate to say it, but when this first hit the news, I've just gotten so numb after hearing so many fucking Islamic terrorist attacks that have been happening in Europe, you know, starting with everything in Paris and these, it's just like even a massacre like this, it's like not a new story anymore. And my first reaction was like, well, I just have to keep some emotional distance here because there's no way until to really figure out what the facts are until the dust is settled. And, you know, it's interesting to speculate, but, to some degree, we'll just have to wait and see. I think it's definitely going to have an impact just on the milieu, on the broader environment of, American democracy, however, which already has been polarized and, you know, heading towards with increasing political violence and things like that. This is just another thing, another crack, another thing that's really upsetting the stability of the American system. It's polarizing. People's reactions to it are polarizing. You see the Democrats really just calling out the whole gun issue and you know, then you have all the conspiracy theorists going on about the, you know, the floor, the number four and all this stuff and whether or not, you know, Mossad was involved and all this, you know, I mean, but it's just a cacophony of theories and, you know, everybody believes what they're going to believe. And, you know, the truth is known by only a handful of people. And if it's damaging to the system, they're going to do their damnedest to keep us from knowing what the truth is. So, you know, that's my general take on it.
Yeah. Yeah. I really have gotten tired of the conspiracy crowd, the people who the blood hasn't even dried and they're coming out with their false flags and their various videos trying to show that something was up.
Yeah.
Crisis actors, anybody who uses that term unironically, I just consign to the category of a crank, basically. And I think that it's a problem. I know that some of these people are liars, and because they'll put out things where they'll say, look, the same woman was here at Sandy Hook and here at the Boston thing. And actually, it's two pictures from Sandy Hook or two pictures from Boston, right? And yeah, yeah. They're claiming, oh, this is evidence that the same crisis actors, the Crisis Actors Guild, right, is being employed at all these events. These people are liars, okay, and they're kooks. Now, the only question is, at what level are they working as liars? Are they cold, self-conscious liars who are just up to mischief, or are they paranoids, basically? Because what I've come to learn from brushes with people who are paranoid, basically, is that paranoids, they see patterns, they see connections that aren't there. Their minds make things up, right? They see stuff that isn't there. It's driven by hate. It's driven by fear. They see stuff that isn't there. And then they're so convinced of it, though, that they'll embroider it by just making self-conscious lies just on the spot to try and hold up their paranoid fantasy and prevent it from being undermined by basically contrary facts. So the question is, you know, are they just sitting back fully, you know, compos mentis, spreading this stuff around for whatever mischievous purposes, or are they sort of mentally out of control? I just don't know. I think it's probably a bit of both. For me, though, I'm not hopeless enough. I'm not nihilistic enough to just want to let all this paranoid conspiracy stuff run amok, and I certainly don't want to encourage it or broadcast it in any way, for the simple reason that you can't build a society or a movement on the foundations of paranoia and epistemological nihilism, because basically these people's belief systems are totally irrational. On the one hand, they have total skepticism towards anything that's mainstream, and yet they're amazingly credulous about anything that comes from the internet, their Facebook feed, YouTube, whatever. And neither one of those attitudes is rational. So it really worries me. I just don't see anything positive coming from a paranoid, low-trust environment that's being fostered by these conspiracy nuts. Now, of course, ultimately what gives them oxygen is the fact that the mainstream press, the mainstream politicians are all lying too. And so they're sort of reaping the whirlwind that they have sown. And I guess really what this basically says is that, look, the guys who are running this country, the people who are in control and think that they can hold on with their lies, well, if they set up lying as their MO and it's obvious that they're lying, then other people are going to become equally cynical. And when you have a society that's totally cynical, then it's not a workable society anymore. The people in power who tell lies still depend on us telling the truth. They tell us lies, and we tell them the truth when we fill in our tax forms. They tell us lies, and we tell the truth when we fill out the crime reports. If we stop telling the truth, if everyone ceases to trust everyone, if everyone is a liar, society grinds to a halt. And that's what I fear. That's what I see coming. And I don't want to encourage that, I guess, because I'm not nihilistic enough to think that everything has to be totally destroyed, because I just don't think you can build anything once everything is totally destroyed like that. If people simply can't trust each other, then there's no foundation for civilized life. So I'm really, really hesitant whenever I see things popping up in my Facebook feed that just vibrate with this paranoid quality, because I don't want to spread it and I don't want to hear it. And I think we need to draw the line at this. And maybe that's just a sign that deep down in my heart, I'm still wedded to the idea that we can save civilization. Maybe not America as a political entity, but maybe at least civilized life, because I think trust is the foundation of civilized life. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe nothing can be done, and maybe we just need to, if it's falling, we need to push. But I just have such a revulsion against liars and paranoia and mistrust that I can't bring myself to get involved with that kind of stuff. It just makes me ill.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, if we put aside the obvious kooks and the attention whores, you know, the people who really stick to these ideas, I think that they imagine that they can weaponize them against, you know, the system. I mean, it's the same thing that 9/11 truthers always tell me when I talk to them, is that, well, you know, this could be the thing that causes the whole establishment to collapse. But the problem is, I mean, they can never prove their ideas to the point that anybody who's not already part of their circle would accept. So, you know, it never really goes beyond that. I mean, I'm open-minded enough that I'm willing to admit that, you know, maybe this guy in Las Vegas, maybe he really was sucked into some kind of weird MK Ultra program and he was, you know, brainwashed into carrying out this attack for some sort of nefarious aim of the deep state. I don't know.
You don't know, and these people don't know either.
Right, yeah, there's no way to prove it. So the problem with these people is that they always think because they can imagine something that it therefore is true.
Right.
And right. That's simply not a way to I mean, people have done the same thing to me over the years. Like, I've been accused of being both a CIA agent and, you know, working for the Kremlin, any number of other agencies. And it's just because people think, you know, that because they can imagine it, and that therefore gives them the ability to dismiss anything I say against it, that therefore makes it true. And that's kind of the way it is here.
Right.
And I think that the most annoying part of it is that they try to make you feel like an idiot for not believing it.
Yeah, and that's an infallible sign that you're dealing with a crank, right?
Yeah.
When you ask them questions and they blow up at you and start hurling accusations, that's a clear sign that they do not have a rational worldview.
Yes. Right.
Oh, you're working for the enemy, aren't you? It's like, yeah, right. Okay.
Right.
It's sort of like religious fundamentalism, but channeled into a different, yeah, you know, different frequency. It's the same kind of logic.
It's the same epistemological nihilism, basically.
Exactly.
This anything goes belief system. And again, you can't build anything on those sorts of foundations. And I'd like to build something. I'd at least like to build a movement and a counterculture and an alternative to all this. And you can't do that with crazies.
You can't build anything, but at the same time, you know, you look back at, you know, right after 9/11, all the 9/11 truthers and the 2000s, they were all just kind of regarded as completely, you know, out there and just kind of conspiracy nuts and everything like that, because the mainstream media had much more public credibility at that time than it does now. You didn't have people, you know, calling out fake news and at that time, and you didn't have accusations being hurled at Russian influence, you know, Russian media is trying to influence U.S. voters and just all the doubtfulness that the American public has now for the mainstream media is new. And that's actually a positive thing, because it gives people some space to look at things and see that a lot of what the mainstream media is putting across is a narrative, that they're paying attention to certain facts and not paying attention to other facts. And now, at least in today's world, you have the possibility for different narratives to be put out there and gain a following, which is necessary for any real change to happen. So insofar as that's happened, that's a good thing.
Yeah, it is good that there is an alternative media, but it would be nice if the alternative media had higher standards than the mainstream media. And generally it does. Generally it does. But there's some stuff out there that just strikes me as very, very bad, very unhealthy. I've been meaning to write an article for years called A Conspiracy Theory of Conspiracy Theories, because I do have a theory about why conspiracy theories exist. And it's about time for me to write it all out. But basically, my take is this, and I've said this in my piece on the 10th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks. right out there on the surface of September 11, there was enough information that led a significant percentage of the U.S. population, like two-thirds of people polled by NBC and Reuters, to conclude that this happened because of our relationship with Israel. I remember the weekend after September 11th, NBC and Reuters both reported polls that I think like 66 and 67% of the populace thought this. And I thought, well, this is good. We need to try and make something of this. Of course, we didn't have the media and the organizations or anything to try and make something out of it. And it ended up being used by the very people who were in the spotlight that the public was seeing through, the Jews, the neocons, the Israel lobby, the very people who had been exposed by this ended up turning it to their advantage, right? So we didn't have any way of turning it to our advantage. There just wasn't enough of a movement then, and we didn't have our own platform sufficiently and so forth. And yet, right there on the surface, it was so good for us. And yet, almost immediately, all these people who are nominally on the right or apparently on the right started in with the conspiracy theories, and it just started spinning out of control. The nanothermite people, the disappearing planes, the hologram people, all that kind of stuff. And whenever you would raise like just moderate, rational questions about what their evidence was for this, or doesn't this seem a little nutty or whatever, they would flip out at you and attack you, which indicates that you're not dealing with rational people. And what that did is, within a year's time, it completely tainted any alternative narratives about 9/11 but the one that was being pushed by the government, with insanity, with the mark of insanity, paranoia, looniness, and so forth. I actually think that the reason why that was done was that the truth about 9/11 was so damaging to the establishment that any alternative view to the mainstream narrative had to be tainted with this insanity. And I believe, therefore, that the establishment was behind a lot of the 9/11 truth movement. The 9/11 quote-unquote, I'm clawing the air with my fingers, truth movement, which I think really did a lot to obscure and throw dust in the eyes of the public about the real truth of this matter.
That was basically the South Park theory.
Is it?
South Park did an episode, well, this is a few years after 9/11, but where Cartman thinks he's discovered proof of, you know, 9/11 having been a conspiracy, and they end up getting abducted by the government, and they're confronted by Bush, and he tells them that, oh, actually, you know, we have to get rid of you boys because, you know, you actually know the truth. Then they escape, and then what they finally realize is that the government deliberately allowed them to escape to spread the idea that the government was behind 9/11, because otherwise they're afraid that people will think that they're not really in control of everything.
Right. Well, that's not exactly what I'm saying. But I do believe that a lot of the 9/11 truth stuff is an enemy operation. It's an enemy operation to taint the real truth about 9/11 with insanity, with the smell of insanity and conspiracy and craziness and crankiness. And I think it was a masterful operation. There is an article that I need to look up and have the facts at my fingertips that was published years ago by Adam Parfrey in the second of his Apocalypse Culture volumes. And in it, he talks about these women who would go around, and they were on the Christian TV talk show circuit, and they'd go to churches and things like that. And they would go out there and they'd describe how they had been sexually abused by all these politicians and prominent people, as starting as children. And they were so over the top and kooky that any sensible person hearing about this stuff would think, well, these are just neurotic attention whores. They're lunatics. And then what happened was after these women had been out there for a while, the news about this black Republican donor, this major donor to the Republican Party, who is in the Midwest and I think in Nebraska, and involved in all kinds of a savings and loan scandal, was also a Satanist and a pedophile. And this writer, whose name escapes me, basically said, look, these women going out there on the talk show circuit obviously seemed nutty and over the top. And therefore, what they were doing is inoculating the public mind against the idea that there could be actual high-level satanic pedophiles in the government, right? In the establishment. And so when one of these people was actually unmasked, it sort of just didn't go anywhere, right? Of course, we didn't have the internet then and so forth, so it was harder to deal with this. But the fact is that it didn't have legs. And I think part of the reason it didn't have legs was that a significant percentage of the population that would actually be inclined to believe this stuff had their minds inoculated with this craziness. And so that's like, oh, I've heard this before. This sounds like so-and-so, and that person sounded like a nut. I do think that basically the public mind is inoculated with conspiracy theories and cranky ideas so that the actual truths that are not so different from these conspiracy theories and cranky ideas basically sound crazy to them when the truth comes out. And since the people who run the society know they can't completely control the news and information, especially now in the world of the internet, they have to inoculate people against scandals getting out. And I think that one of the ways that they do this is by running these operations that basically taint the truth with the mark of insanity and paranoia. So that's my conspiracy theory of conspiracy theories.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, you'd see how that could be the case. I wonder, sometimes, though, you know, I think Alex Jones, I mean, he's definitely doing it partially, you know, for money, partially just for the entertainment value. I mean, he kind of knows that what Anglin and Weave over at Daily Stormer know, which is that, you know, you have to affect people on this kind of gut emotional level and just be outrageous and just kind of, you know, shock people in order to, you know, get information into their heads. And I think, you know, he's doing that. You know, you could say he's a conspiracy theorist, and a lot of what he says is absolutely outrageous. And, you know, doesn't have the sort of, you know, documentation that would allow it to be published in, you know, more quote unquote reputable mainstream outlets, you know, and not even just mainstream outlets. We're talking as far as, you know, the enemy media is concerned, but even just more reputable alternative media. But I think still he's on our side. I think, I mean, not, you know, aligned with us per se, but aligned with kind of pursuing the truth and, you know, being, opposing the globalists. And
yeah, but the globalists, he says, are a bunch of secret Nazis practicing eugenics.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there was actually a series, the name escapes me right now, Homeland, I think. But one of the recent seasons of Homeland actually featured a guy who was basically a knockoff of Alex Jones.
Yeah, and some of the reviewers were calling him not Alex Jones.
Right, right.
Yeah, it was last season.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, you could see somebody like that, you know, possibly being some kind, you know, but I mean, even this is just kind of conspiracy theorizing on our own to speculate whether, you know, the government is involved with funding various false flags or disinformation and whatnot. So,
well, look, we do know that these things have happened before. We do know that they fund disinformation. And I'm just basing this on my own psychology in a way. If I were the establishment and I knew that we couldn't keep all information from circulating, I would then have to come up with a way of inoculating the public so that damaging information doesn't actually do any damage to the people in power. And the best way of doing that is to circulate this stuff ourselves and to taint it, to denature it, right? So that it doesn't nourish the minds of the public. It simply just poisons the mind of the public. That's what I would do if I were running the society. And I think that the people who are running the society, well, there are a lot more of them than me, and a lot of them are a lot smarter than me. So I expect they're doing that and a whole lot more that's nefarious. And the people who are hopping up and down and shrieking these really wild theories and attacking you viciously if you question them, even in the most mild-mannered way, I think they're either working for the enemy or they're basically just freelance kooks who are being gaslighted by the enemy. And I don't think they're helping. I think they harm us. And I think they objectively, they help the enemy. Whether they're doing that intentionally or just accidentally is an open question. But I would not be surprised if some of them are doing it intentionally. Again, if I were guarding the interests of the establishment in Western societies, that's exactly what I would be doing. These are the exact kind of people I would have out there, basically pissing in the swimming pool of the far right, you know, making it an unpleasant environment to swim in, denaturing the alcohol so it poisons us, right, or whatever. There are a lot of metaphors you could use, but I do think that is a reasonable assumption to make, that it is happening. And once you have that lens in place, I think it makes a lot of sense out of what we're seeing. But it's not equivalent to proving that any given person who's behaving this way is actually an enemy agent. I wouldn't go so far as to say that. That's not warranted by this line of reasoning. You'd actually have to have positive evidence. And one thing that I do think we have to do is, because we don't want to fall into this paranoid style, is we cannot go around claiming that so-and-so is an enemy agent, Weave is an enemy agent, or Nathan D'Amico is an enemy agent, or whatever, because for whatever reason they remind you of what an enemy agent might do. We can't do that. I think that that's a no-no. There should be a strong, strong pushback against that kind of behavior. Because, again, we should have standards. We should have standards of argument and proof. But at the same time, we should also have realistic assumptions about how information is massaged and managed and tainted by the liars who rule our societies. And, again, they'd be fools not to have their people in the alternative media poisoning it.
Now, I'd say overall, if there is a disinformation campaign by the establishment, and it's very likely there is, it's backfired terribly against the establishment media. And, generationally speaking, the millennials and Generation Z have decreasing trust in mainstream news outlets and are entirely researching through alternative media and through just YouTube videos and through, just a more social media style thing, which puts the onus on the people doing, getting the news that way to fact check on their own and just be more skeptical on their own. Mm-hmm. But, to the extent that that's can develop critical thinking among the younger generations, I think that's kind of a good thing and a necessary thing.
If it does lead to people to develop critical thinking skills, but my fear is that it's propagating epistemological nihilism and a paranoid low-trust mentality. And at a certain point, people are going to stop believing it, too. And then where do we go, right? I mean, maybe I should shut up about this because I'm spreading low-trust memes and skepticism about this. But I think we have to do that. We have to do that because it's clear that something is wrong here. Something is amiss.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly polarizing. It certainly, you know, forms it's forming echo chambers where people have, you know, decided on their own what the truth is and are, you know, limiting what they're willing to consider.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. We're creating all these little bubbles, and society is disintegrating. My question is, do people in power think that this is a good thing or a bad thing? Do they think they're going to hold on to things better if they create a completely disintegrated, low-trust environment or not? I think on one level they might believe that because it's almost impossible to create social solidarity against them in such an environment. And in a way, it's an extension of the very problem that we've been decrying all this time, which is the problem of diversity, right? The more diverse a society is, the less solidarity, the less trust, and so forth. And that increases the power of the elites, or at least they think it does. And the same thing is happening in the realm of information. If there are all kinds of different alternative platforms for getting your news and entertainment now, and people live in little echo chambers, they don't trust things outside their little world that they live in, doesn't that undermine social solidarity and make it more difficult for there to be resistance against the establishment? Isn't it the same problem as diversifying everything racially? Even if we had a monoracial society, if everything is broken down into low-trust subgroups that basically are in little bubbles and regard one another with suspicion, they're never going to be able to unite against the people who rule us.
I forget who first put this theory forward. I think it might have been, I don't know if Jack Donovan was the first to originate it, but, you know, the whole tribal mindset, which is that, you know, human beings only evolutionarily speaking have the capacity to really socially form bonds with tribes of, you know, up to 100 or so people.
And, yeah,
and it's all about kind of forming your own status within that tribe, within that circle of influence. I think small groups of highly committed individuals can really dictate, you know, really change society. So I think that that's what's what's starting to congeal right now is that sort of thing. The coordination that resulted in, you know, Charlottesville, as much of a clusterfuck that was, it still was, you know, a coordinated action at one place and one time among, you know, the network of, you know, people who have all stepped against the mainstream and want to make some action. In the future, that action doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, street activism, although it might be, but it could be getting ideas out there for creating new publishing and media ventures. I kind of think that on one level, yeah, it's a breakdown of the mass society, but that's kind of what's necessary. And you know, I mean, we do need to kind of head in this direction of highly developed, highly formed, committed networks of people who are committed to changing things for the better, and not only committed, but also have the truth on their side, which I think ultimately we do.
Right, right. The thing, though, is that I kind of want to save civilization, and you can't really save civilization by just regressing to the level of tribes. Civilization requires a different kind of trust, because you know, you don't know everybody, in a civilized society. You can't know everybody in a civilized society. So how do you coordinate with them? Well, you coordinate with them with things like money, exchange money, or you have the same language and you can communicate with them. And people carry around within them a commitment, an ethical commitment to a certain kind of behavior that doesn't need to be ratified by looking at their family tree or whatever, right? In a tribal society, when two people meet, this is true in like Somalia or something like that. In a tribal society, when two strangers meet, they don't know if they're friends or enemies until they go through their names. They have these long, long names, which are just lists of their ancestors. And if they can find that they got some common ancestor, then they can be a friend. But if they don't, then they're enemies. Obviously, that makes it very, very difficult to have any kind of large-scale organizations and large-scale cooperation. Everything stays small and tribal. And whenever you have any kind of larger scale organizations that are, say, built by white people, if these people come in, what they do is they hollow it out and colonize it with their little ethnic mafias. But the thing breaks down because you can't get the best people in the best job, and you simply can't find enough people that you can trust to work with in a large organization if you have that small scale tribal mentality. And so what made Western civilization possible was the fact that people carried around an ethical commitment to keep their promises, to be fair, and things like that. And if you met a stranger in one of these societies and, you know, they spoke your language and they dressed in a way that communicated, trustworthiness. They weren't stinking bums, right? And they had other clues, other sort of symbolic cues. If they had money to pay you, right, and so on and so forth, you could associate with them, strike deals, make if their credentials checked out, right, from their schools, whatever. You could trust them and you could work together, and you didn't have to be a member of the same small scale group. And this is why in Western civilization, you have these enormous institutions that function very, very well. Giant corporations and charities and armies and hospitals and all kinds of huge institutions like this work well because people can trust one another simply as a human being, right? This is our individualism in a way, right? Every individual carries around a certain mentality, a certain ethos, a certain commitment to fair dealing and so forth. So you don't have to belong to the same small group to trust them, and you can slot them into your giant organization, and you can, have the Manhattan Project or NASA or whatever. You can't do that with small tribes of 150 people. And so my fear is that just regressing to a tribe or this fifth political theory idea of the diaspora community is not enough. It might be a useful thing as a tool of political and community organization for our movement, but the end game of our movement, I think, should still be defined as saving civilization, not as coming up with a small-scale tribal alternative to it. Because if that's all we can do, then we've lost almost everything.
I tend to agree, although I think people like Jack, and I guess you could even say, Avila to an extent, because he was kind of advocating for the same thing towards the end of his life with this apolitaia idea, is that civilization has sort of gone past the point of being anything that we can relate to, including Western civilization, so that therefore this is the only alternative for us now. Well, maybe in Jack's case, maybe he really does see the tribal form as just being superior. But I think for most people who advocate that idea, it's more just a fallback measure because they think, civilization is so far gone that that's the best we can manage right now.
Right. Everything that we should do in our organizing should be a multi-purpose tool. So, for instance, if we are creating local communities of aware people, they should function like a little tribe, and they should be helpful that way. And if we create a kind of diaspora community where we cooperate across borders all across the world and couch surf and all over Europe and America, I mean, we do that stuff already. If we do that kind of thing, that's also very useful. But the goal should be to save our civilization. And if we can't do that, well, then we've got plan B, which is to be an aware diaspora people or a little tribe, right, in a network of tribes. Those are fallback positions, but those are fallback positions only if we're defeated almost totally in the great game that we face, which is saving our civilization. Because if we regress to tribes, it might be kind of cute to think that we can go back to being Vikings or something like that, but you can't do that in a world with nuclear-armed superpowers. You just become, we'll just become the Afghans of the future. We don't want to become the Afghans of the future.
I think Mark Dial probably wants that. But
he can think that, but honestly, it's not a sustainable option. It's not a sustainable alternative in a world with nuclear weapons and huge armies. I honestly think that the great black pill that I contemplate but never swallow is China. China is a mess. China has all kinds of internal problems. It's a low trust, high IQ society. The Chinese are very pessimistic about their future, so it's not smart for us to be too pessimistic about our future vis-a-vis China, because the Chinese are putting all their assets on the West Coast in North America, for instance, if they can get them out. So that said, China is moving full bore ahead with eugenics, and the West isn't.
Yeah.
And what's preventing the West from doing that? Well, basically Christianity and liberal humanism. We are hobbling ourselves with those mind viruses, that mentality. And in 50 or 100 years, if we continue to hobble ourselves and they are not hobbled by these ideas, they're going to be so much smarter than us. We're just going to be like, Abos are to us today. Just a totally negligible race of morons, basically. And they're not going to be so sentimental about us that they're going to want to build reservations for us. They're just going to want to get rid of us. I honestly feel that that is the most dangerous possibility in the future. And it's simply because it'll happen simply because we indulge ourselves with these humanistic, religious, every sperm is sacred, everybody's got a soul kinds of childlike nonsense. We can't have cloning. Why? Because, well, that would be unfair. I mean, people have these attitudes, you know. It's like, well, we're doomed then. We're simply doomed in a world where these technologies can be taken up by other people without those scruples.
I agree with you, but I also feel like some caution is warranted because, you know, the history of communism and, you know, China, at least nominally, is still, you know, somewhat a communist country. I mean, it has a history of, you know, they embrace any progressive technically progressive idea without any regard for the consequences, which is why the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe are environmentally ruined because, you know, they had no concern for the effect that industrialization was having on the environment. And I feel like it's possible the Chinese might get ahead, but they also, you know, they might be screwing themselves over too.
Yeah, well, they might release a virus that destroys the entire planet. You know, I mean,
yeah,
which is just another form of the same black pill. They might not end up ruling over us. They might just end up ruining the world entirely. Yeah, that's another possibility.
And there was a professor I knew at Michigan years ago who made the interesting. His field was actually bioethics. And I attended a lecture he gave once, and he made the interesting point that, you know, the only thing, well, he did point out that there are, you know, like you said, there's still these Christian moral objections, certain things that scientists want to do. But he also pointed out that, you know, other than that, really the main thing that governs scientific progress in the U.S. today is just its ability to make money. And he was always calling for, you know, he thought there should be some sort of institution that could govern scientific progress, not just in America, but in the whole world, that would say, well, just because we can do something doesn't mean that we should, and that, you know, these things should be thoroughly studied before anything is actually implemented. Because so he pointed out, too, that there our technology is to the point now that we can actually do things that would wipe all of us out forever. And it, maybe it was a bit utopian for him to think that, but I think it is a very good idea, because
right,
we're meddling in things that man was not meant to know, perhaps. I mean,
right.
I know that's very un-Faustian of me, but
right.
You know, there are definite risks involved in some of the things that we're playing with now.
Yeah, definitely. There are some serious risks that we face.
No, I was just going to say, I'm skeptical of the degree to which China could get itself ahead, at least in the area of bioengineering and eugenics, just because we live in an information age that's interconnected, and having to keep that information secret and that knowledge secret for the period of time that they would have to do to, you know, breed a race of supermen, you know, seems unlikely, but it's something to be aware of. And I just think that as soon as China figures out how, you know, once they clone the first human, create the first artificial womb and all this stuff, and I just think that that's going to be, that knowledge is going to be out there, and it's not going to be something.
Oh, yeah, it'll be out there. They could declare their intentions from the rooftops and on the front page of every newspaper. But if the West is totally beholden to these ideas that, well, we can't engage in embryo selection, that's abortion, that's killing a baby, or, you know, this is unfair, or basically these obscurantist attitudes on the left that basically deny that genetics is anything at all, you know, they can announce their intentions to the world, and we're not going to do anything about it because we're too fucking stupid. And we're not stupid in the technical sense of low IQ. We're stupid because we're moral imbeciles, because we have certain moral attitudes that will destroy us, because they're going to prevent us from taking advantage of certain genetic certain scientific possibilities that people without the Christian and liberal traditions are willing to take advantage of. And so the Far East doesn't have the Bible as a significant influence. It doesn't have liberal humanism and egalitarianism as a significant influence. It doesn't have a kind of reflexive individualism as a significant influence. And therefore, they're just willing to take advantage of whatever these technologies offer. And I do think that that is probably the greatest danger that we face, I think, as a race, ultimately. Again, it all comes back to our own moral attitudes. If we can change our thinking, we can liberate ourselves. But, you know, the clock is ticking. The clock just isn't ticking demographically. We already know that. It's also ticking technologically, and we need to take that into account as well. We've got to empty our heads of these anti-survival moral notions and come up with an ethos that embraces survival and flourishing of our race, or we're finished. And if we, you know, decline to a certain degree through race mixing and chaos and so forth, well, the people who don't burden themselves with diversity and don't burden themselves with individualism and liberal humanism are simply going to walk all over us. The world will be theirs.
That's where I see the opportunity for the tribe coming about, and that, you know, smaller groups that are distanced from the broader civilization but are highly networked and can form a vanguard that create the seeds of a new civilization. I think that's the way things, the directions things need to head.
Yeah, the tribe has to be a vanguard. It cannot just be an escape hatch. It cannot be the equivalent of another gated community. And that's what I fear a lot of people who are just talking about tribalism are engaged in. It's just another version of the old American Calvinistic idea that we're going to build a shining city on a hill away from the corrupt society, a place where all the elect, the remnant, go. And it could be basically just a low-tech gated community. I mean, we do this all the time, right? It strikes me as another form of white flight, unless it really understands itself as a vanguard that is trying to save our civilization, our nation, and our civilization. Otherwise, it's just white flight and LARPing, I'm afraid.
No, I agree.
We have to get Riki to write something on this.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I just finished reading Jason Giorgiani's new book, World State of Emergency, where he talks a lot about genetics and all the prospects for eugenics and genetic engineering and so forth, and how the West simply has attitudes that prohibit progress in this area, whereas the Far East, especially China, doesn't. And unfortunately, I don't see that he offers a solution to this problem. It's just sort of a giant black pill. It's just another ticking clock that we have to deal with. And if we can change our people's mentality to stop our demographic crisis and the immigration invasion and everything else, we'll automatically change their attitudes about the eugenics crisis, the brain race, right? It's not the race for space. It's the race for superior brains and stuff like that. But of course, once we have those, the space race will be nothing, right? It'll be the kind of problem that a 12-year-old child will be solving in 100 years in the future, right? Because we could be so much smarter on average than we are today. So, yeah.
Well, of course, it's all still theoretical, but yeah, it's possible.
Somebody will solve the gravity equation.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it is important to remember that we don't actually know that these things are possible, but, you know, I mean, they certainly are. But we could, even if we're just normal and they all become supermen, I mean, we could always just default on our interest payments.
Yeah, well.
That'll stop them in their tracks.
At a certain point, the whole money economy thing is just going to go out the window anyway. I think technology is just going to change that.
Yeah. The whole alt tech development and distributed internet and everything like that is part of this development.
Yeah, the idea of interest-bearing money and stuff like that. I think all that can one day somebody will press a button and it'll all go away. And we'll have arrived at technological utopia. The only question is, will it be white people or will it be Asians that arrive there? So, guys, we should wrap up. You guys are planning on being in Belgium this coming weekend by the time most people are listening to this. So, John, Mike, do you want to tell us a little bit about that for our Shop Talk segment, and then we'll wrap up?
Yeah, well, there is this group in Belgium, in Flanders specifically. It's being organized by some people who were affiliated with the Flemish NSV, you know, the nationalist / regionalist Flemish movement in Flanders. And the group is known as the May 6 Committee. And May 6 refers to the Martyrs' Day in Syria. And this is not an Islamic holiday. This was a holiday to commemorate martyrs to the nationalist cause in Syria, and I believe in Lebanon as well. And the point of this event is on Saturday afternoon in Antwerp, there's going to be a march to sort of honor those who have given their lives in fighting against ISIS and the other insurgent groups in Syria over the last 6.5 years. And then in the evening, there's going to be a sort of, well, I don't know if it's exactly a conference, but more like a a series of speeches, which will include myself kind of discussing various aspects of what's happened in Syria. They asked me to speak on the new rights approach to Syria. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit, as well as, you know, the perspective of being an American who, you know, disagrees with what has been U.S. policy, at least until very recently, in Syria. Well, I don't know if it's that much better now, although at least Trump has ended the funding to the Syrian rebels. But, you know, I'm going to make it clear in my speech that I don't consider myself exactly to be pro-Assad. I mean, I realize that the guy is a dictatorial bastard, and, you know, certainly the Syrian people have a legitimate problems with the regime. But at the same time, anybody who looks at the history of what happened there could see that this was not a legitimate democratic uprising of the will of the Syrian people. I mean, this was something that it was, you know, Islamic radicals, many of whom were coming from other countries, backed by the U.S. and Israel and other countries, who attempted to destroy Assad. So I'm going to try to address that and kind of, you know, spin it in kind of a broader political context as well. I'm not exactly clear on who else is going to be speaking, but I'm sure it's going to be a fascinating event for anybody who is in Europe and is interested in this sort of thing.
Well, that sounds very interesting. I wish I could be there. So, guys, I think we should wrap up. We've gone on for more than an hour now. I think this has been a very good conversation, and so we'll be back next week for another episode of Countercurrents Radio.
See you all later.
Take care, everyone.